Hello and welcome to the VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour and I'm joined by Matt Graham.
Hello, Mike.
And we're here at the LA Convention Center for our SIGGRAPH recording of our VFX show. And this is a film you didn't really like, Matt.
If only you could say that. I absolutely love this film. I don't know if I enjoyed WALL-E more or about on par with The Incredibles, but I think Pixar did it again, just another cracking film.
Yes, we thought we'd discuss The Incredible. We thought we'd discuss WALL-E. You tripped me there.
Sorry.
I thought we'd choose a film that was animated, obviously because of SIGGRAPH, and that's been a particularly good choice because we've managed to see a lot of interesting behind-the-scenes stuff, both to do with RenderMan and to do with the making of WALL-E, everything from how Massive was used in it and everything else. But as always, we want to start with the discussion of the film just as a film, and then we'll quickly move to what would normally be visual effects. So in this case, we're going to try and discuss some of the animation issues involved. So let's start by just your general impression. You actually got to see the film in a particularly good viewing environment.
I did. I went to the El Capitan, I think, cinema down on Hollywood Boulevard. And I've got to say, that was an amazing experience. I mean, everything from the organ player coming up from the floor, the 10, 15-minute floor show of various singing and dancing costumes. It was awesome. And then, of course, we got into Presto, the film short just before WALL-E.
Let me ask you, was that a digital projection?
You know what? I don't know.
I have seen digital projection at that cinema. It was superb. I mean, but to tell you the truth, they really calibrate their throws really well in that cinema. So I'm not surprised if on a good print, you know, I mean, like on a sort of a crappy cinema multiplexy thing, you know, obviously the print looks really hacked and stuff, but that has to be kind of Disney's premier theater. And so it just is a very, very good viewing environment. Also, the audio is so good, isn't it?
It was. It was an old theatre, and I wasn't expecting it to be calibrated so well. Actually, now that I think of it, I'm usually the kind of person that comes out of a film complaining about dust and scratches, and maybe that's just because I see most of my films in Australia and we get the secondhand prints half the time. But
well,
it looks,
I will
very
say
clean.
This: if there was ever a film that you wanted to see with good audio, in terms of just sound design, I think this was it. But before we even hit WALL-E, we really do need to do a shout out to the film that preceded it. In other words, the short from Pixar. Now, Pixar built its entire company on its shorts. I mean, starting with Luxo Jr. and working its way forward. And I must admit, it's a treat to see a Pixar short like that, isn't it?
I don't want to overhype it, but I think it's one of the best.
Yeah, I mean, it has a timing and a kind of, I don't know, attitude that is very reminiscent of old style, almost, you know, Willy Coyote kind of, I don't know, but also was fresh.
Yeah, and you really cared about the two main characters. And just the way they interacted with each other. And while they were, you know, doing the usual throwing anvils at each other kind of thing, there was still love and compassion between the two.
Well, what's interesting, though, is that it wasn't just, you know, good cop, bad cop, because, you know, it wasn't like we just didn't care about the magician. We didn't, you know, he wasn't a bastard, an evil guy that we wanted to see killed. So it was a very interesting performance. And I mean that in both senses of the word. And I think it was great. I think the timing of it, as I say, you can't beat, but it also had a very sort of rich tapestry of colors, textures. I mean, I was looking around the room at one point, the dressing room. I saw these sort of flowers behind and detail and stuff. Oh, just gorgeous. Okay, so then the main feature starts, and as we mentioned a moment ago, sound design particularly important, but let's just discuss your impressions of the plot, the film in general.
Attention to detail throughout. I mean, it's a perfect example of a craft and an art that, you know, you have complete control of every single nuance throughout the entire film. And they really did refine every single thing. I mean, WALL-E's van where he keeps all his trinkets, the attention to detail and the thought behind every single thing in there was just amazing.
Apparently, Andrew Stanton was at some kind of, I think it was like a baseball game. I was going to say a Cubs game. I've got Cubs games on the mind, but it might have been a baseball game. And he had a pair of binoculars, and he was looking at the binoculars and thinking, you know what? That's all you really need for a face, the eyes. And of course, now when you look at WALL-E, I can't help but see the binoculars on top. But it is pretty remarkable how expressive that you can get that character with no mouth, no, you know, actual kind of eyebrowsy facial expression stuff, hardly any ability to do character posing of the body, because let's face it, he doesn't have a very well flexible body, and no audio in the way of dialogue. I mean, this is kind of working with both hands tied behind your back, and yet I couldn't think of a more expressive character that I was more rooting to win going into when obviously the dialogue started than Wally.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if you could actually watch this film without any audio whatsoever, and you'd still get the message, I think.
And yet, I would be therefore missing out on Ben Burtt's superb sound design. Now, I can't. There are two things that struck me about this film, and we're going to move now, I guess, from the plot, which obviously we like. And full spoiler alert: we're going to both be, you know, busting the plot if you haven't seen it, and discussing some of the geeky technical stuff. So moving now to how they did it. Ben Burtt actually was the guy that did C-3PO and, you know, famous for Star Wars and all the robots in that.
Yeah, he's an amazing sound designer. He's just been, he's done every big film known to man.
And apparently the sound design, in terms of the samples that were used, this one even blew out of the water what they'd done on Star Wars. And of course on Star Wars he's famous for, you know, combining all sorts of weird sounds for Chewbacca and all this kind of stuff. So Wally, but there was one sound, and I'm going to let you guess what it was, that just had me in hysterics. You know what it was?
Could it be every time he recharged his battery, they had that classic Mac restart?
That was. I mean, there was, I think, three or four Mac owners in the cinema when I saw it, and we all just broke up laughing.
Yeah,
I also think I'm right in saying that Ives, who is the designer of the Mac, and particularly, you know, the industrial designer that gave Apple its fame, actually designed Eve. And of course, Steve Jobs was the owner of Pixar, principal owner. Now, of course, it's been part of Disney, and Steve Jobs sits on the board of Disney. But you know, it would have been very easy to get him, of course, for that gig. But the attention to detail, as you said, just superb. So let's break it down by scenes. We're going to start with the maybe scenes is the wrong way to describe it. Locations. Let's start with the location of Earth with the trash. And I don't know, for me, it was both epic, depressing, and beautiful.
Yeah, actually, the perfect summary. It was very distressing seeing the Earth like that, but it's just so powerful. The selection of shots throughout the film were great to tell the story and you know, give you that kind of awesome spectacle of huge masses of pile and detail throughout.
Well, normally we discuss visual effects and how they pulled it off, though, of course, in this case, we need to discuss the 3D rendering. So let's discuss the garbage for a second. I was lucky enough to speak to some of the Pixar guys here at the show. What's interesting is that if you go to Cars for a second, Cars obviously had the huge reflections in the cars, and that was the first time that that RenderMan introduced ray tracing. Now, the ray tracing gives you the perfect reflections on the cars, but actually doesn't give you any of the radiosity or the indirect bounce light that, that you know, we really have as a hallmark of really great animation in terms of, you know, the technical rendering of it. And so after that, I mean, I thought they would. After that, they developed this technique, which is called brick maps, which is you kind of model the entire environment independent of the camera for a second and work out where all the indirect light is coming from. And to simplify the process down, if you think of a whole lot of sort of three-dimensional sort of Lego pieces, and those Lego pieces contain information or energy information about where light is dispersing, you kind of build a Lego map in three space of the entire scene. And then as you're producing the rendered frames, you actually sort of send out rays, and they hit these bricks and they give it a summary of what sort of light would be coming from that direction. This is a very crude explanation of brick maps. That was all developed between Cars and around the time of Ratatouille. But in fact, Ratatouille's pipeline did not use radiance. They may have used a couple of little things in it, but primarily that was a film that had subsurface scattering and some other cool things, but wasn't really a radiance pass, with the exception of some of the copper pots in the kitchen that have these lovely sort of glossy textures. And I know you'd agree that Ratatouille did look very, very good.
That was amazing. And yeah, the subsurface scattering and giving that richer texture to all the foods was just, you felt like you were smelling that food.
But of course, if we were to compare them just completely technically for a second, the shiny environments and the highly reflective metalwork of, sounds like I've got a speech impediment, I think I'm just tired, highly reflective environment of Wally was closer, in fact, to Cars than the kind of more organic world of Paris and Ratatouille. And so they did come to use the brick maps in Wally, and of course a new point cloud technique, which was discussed here at SIDGRAPH. And that point cloud technique is even an addition beyond the brick maps. and involves the same sort of thing, but instead of going to sort of three-dimensional Lego pieces, it's actually going to stochastic octree representation of the energy levels in a point cloud. Now, what's happening in doing this is that we're getting this indirect lighting, which means that when you have an environment like Earth and you have like all this garbage with all these tonal values to it, all of that is bouncing around and giving you this very realistic and warm light.
Yeah, it was really amazingly beautiful richness in all the contrasts and tones. And I think one thing Pixar does really, really well is they set the boundaries and the feel of any scene, and they stay within those constraints. Like, just the way the characters move, you know, it follows through every single piece of character animation, and it's all credible.
Absolutely. Well, just for the geeky amongst you, you might be interested to know, and this is a complete thing I didn't know. This is like uber geeky value. I realize I'm going off the dial with the geek value, but actually this idea of the brick maps that I mentioned before, obviously Wally was actually making kind of solid hunks of garbage, right? Hmm. And if you think about it from a geometry point of view, what you're actually doing is getting lots of geometry and cramming it in a relatively small space, which means that it's pretty polygon intensive, these little cubes. And we had gazillions of them lying around. And so they actually worked out that as they contained all the energy profile of light from that particular area, they could actually do effectively a scientific visualization of the brick map. And voila, they got the brick that was Wally's garbage brick.
They're just trying to be clever now.
So for those far-off scenes, if you're wondering how they managed to pull off that amount of geometry, because it is like a dense piece of geometry, those garbage blocks. In those wide shots where he's sort of building the towers, those blocks are actually visualizations of the the Radiance brick maps in their own right. And it's technically insanely clever doing that. And I must admit, I was just in awe of... I'm famous actually for posting. I said I had a man crush on the developers that did that because I just thought that was such a cool technique. So that's the Earth. And of course, not only were the textures so well done, what we've discussed pretty much is a still frame, but in fact there was little subtle movements of blowing bits of paper and stuff all through those wide shots. It could have otherwise been effectively still matte paintings.
Yeah, throughout the film they did staying on Earth. I mean, there's a couple of scenes where I think Pixar just, you know, they're just showing off in what they could really do with textures and surfaces. There's the one shot where he's you know, taking Eve on the gondola ride, and it's the only time you really see a fluid on Earth, and it's the depth and
and not only with the depth but the complexity of it. And again, they had to develop really good memory management techniques to just get that much of geometry to actually render. It was extraordinary. And I loved everything about that. I loved the nature of the smoke plumes from the ship landing and the dust cloud of the impending you were commenting on the water, weren't you, of the gondola scene that just
Yeah, that was just... It was the only time you saw that kind of fluid on Earth, and the rest is all kind of smokiness. But they just don't shy away from a challenge. If they're going to do something, they do it grand and huge and emotive.
And by visual contrast, when Eve takes off, having got the little plant, and goes up to the Axiom ship, we now have the exact opposite. Shiny, perky, beautiful environment, which is... and, of course... Everybody's done spaceships, right? But what did you actually think of the design of the Axiom?
I thought it was good. I mean, it's hard to do an original, exciting spaceship because, you know, we've seen so many great spaceships over the years, but, you know, it served its purpose well.
I liked it a lot. I thought it was pretty good. It was obviously, as you say, like hard to something to completely original.
I liked the lines within the spaceship, how all the robots had to follow their designated line, and it wasn't a Wally that got there and started breaking off those lines. A nice little subtle plot kind of...
Actually, interestingly, you know those lines on the ground? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the massive software that we know from Lord of the Rings. Yeah. So it's kind of funny, but they developed this software for doing massive car traffic, and they called the product, or that part of massive, Lanes. So they developed this thing called Lanes, and the idea was that when you were populating a city, you might want to use Massive to have all the traffic going up and down the city, right? Seemed like a good idea. Well, Pixar took that and used that part of Massive and Massive software in its sort of most procedural form, and developed all of that Lane stuff using Massive. So that was Massive software doing that, using their Lane stuff. But interestingly, the robots were procedurally animated by the actual Pixar animators. So they went in, and all those little robots were all acting based on effectively procedural elements and weren't hand animated and individually keyframed.
They were amazing. I mean, it's basically, it was a big geek visual homage, I guess, to all the styles and techniques that they got to employ on the film.
Yeah, I mean, I should add, of course, when I say they weren't, you know, hand animated, of course, they were hand animated for the scenes that they were doing stuff that was, you know, I mean, you know, the cleaning up of Wally in the initial sequence and stuff, obviously. But when they were flying around on the lanes,
scenes and
yeah, that was all
scenes,
procedurally
yeah.
animated. And I mean, if you look at the art of Pixar's Wall-E book, the designs for the humans, what they devolved into, I do mean de-evolved,
yep.
That was pretty much an up-for-grabs thing. Like they sometime were thinking of actually having them much more slug-like. And there was sort of a line to be walked there between making them ugly and completely kind of non-sympathetic characters and also getting across the idea that they become just blobs that sat around with what horribly looked like internet screens in front of them playing virtual golf. But I was pretty comfortable with that character design. Did that work for you?
It did. I mean, that's another thing that Pixar does well. Obviously, it gets tricky once you're trying to replicate a human face in a cartoon. So by, you know, making it their own kind of character and giving it a reason for it, it's far more successful and believable for the audience.
Did it bug you that they had the live-action sequence of the President of Earth?
It did, but it didn't. I mean, I personally didn't love it, but the rest of the film was so great, I was willing to buy it.
Yeah, because we saw that in the Academy Award-winning Happy Feet, where they had the people around the pool area when he was captured as being live-action, and it bothered me there. I mean, it actually, I was like, what the...
Yeah, I got bothered by about 15 minutes and couldn't get to the end of Happy Feet, I'm afraid. Just too many songs and too much...
Well, I thought the quality of the shaders and renderer on Happy Feet was superb.
Yes, definitely.
I mean, those shots of the penguins jumping off the ice and just the ice itself was magnificent. I did feel it took a bit of a left-hand turn and then a U-turn and then backed up and then went another completely different direction once it did the environmental flip. But having said that, I do think it was superb work by the guys at Animalogic.
Definitely,
so.
Yeah.
But in this case, it didn't really take a left turn. Wall-E, I don't think... Didn't feel like a film that had been through multiple rewrites and they were hacking it together in the edit.
Not perfect. Again, just precision with every single aspect of the film, the keeping the story true. And the cinematography throughout the film, I think, was just superb. You know, the lens, subtle lens and focus pulls.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, yeah, because that was one of the things that I, even from the trailer, actually, I noticed in the trailer.
You like that trolley shot.
The trolley shot was, for me, just the flag going up. Oh, my God, they're doing something much, much different with the camera. And interestingly, they actually took out guys to Pixar who were DOPs or directors of photography, and they actually took out real cameras and filmed for the Pixar guys a whole bunch of stuff and discussed them. So really subtle things, like anyone that's put a camera on a tripod would know that when you pan the tripod, you're not panning around the nodal point of the lens, you're panning around the weight center of the camera, because otherwise the tripod tips up. And of course, in computer graphics, you tend to pan at the nodal point, so you get these perfect mathematical pans. And so they actually mounted with an offset all their cameras in Wall-E. So when they did a pan, it wasn't a perfect pan, it wasn't a nodal pan, to use the correct technical term. As a consequence, felt better. And then they did things like pulling focus, adjusting zoom, not quite perfectly framing it. I mean, there were so many aspects to the camera work, just magnificent.
I think it helped humanize them by keeping an organic feel to, you know, how it was being presented. I mean, we didn't get any of those huge Spider-Man kind of flying through the air shots, which, you know, I think really take you out of a film by keeping it an organic, natural camera selection and focus kind of.
Yeah, tricks. I mean, even when they're out in space doing the ballet with the fire hydrant, fire extinguisher.
There was no extravagant kind of camera moves there. It was just simple.
I mean, there's some nice flying stuff when they were flying around the spaceship and stuff, and I was concerned about them getting toasted in the exhaust jets of the engine.
Yeah, that's one bit that kind of stretched it for me.
Well,
I know they're robots and, you know, super strength robots, and you can already withstand a couple of explosions on Earth, but, you know, when you're flying around with giant gas burners at the back of a ship, you think someone's going to get toasted.
Yeah, no, I actually really thought that was going to be a gag, that we'd be lulled into a false sense of loving and then one of them would get zicked and we'd be like, that would be a gag, but no, it wasn't to be. And, you know, I mean, there are so many aspects that we can applaud on that, but I guess the one that I didn't expect to be really impressed with is, and I mean, you know, this has now become absurd for how much I love this film, but they land on Earth, the film's finished, end titles. I even loved the end titles.
So true. The little 8-bit kind of animations, that was awesome. And, like, that's the thing, Pixar are now, like a lot of people, thinking about the credits and making sure you stay there.
Yeah, and there was this whole sort of end story that was played out with the end credit. I mean, if you left the cinema as soon as the film effectively ended and the end credits started, you'd have missed out on a whole kind of rebirth of civilization on Earth sort of plot thing that was played out in mosaics and cave drawings. And
that was nice.
Oh my God. I mean, you know, and it's just, again, somebody loved it, you know what I mean? Somebody took the time to really love that. And of course, you could, you know, easily argue that was superfluous and you didn't need it, but, you know.
No, I always, you know, otherwise you're sitting there wondering, is there going to be a sequel? And, you know, I'm not a big fan of most sequels, so it's nice that they gave us some closure and hopefully won't, you know, milk the plot line.
The next film in the sequence is Up, which is already getting rave kind of early buzz, and nearly all the Pixar stuff is now going to 3D, so stereoscopic. I wonder, you know, they're going to redo the original Toy Story, Toy Story 2 in stereo. Would you like to see Wall-E in 3D?
I'm not overly excited by 3D. As long as it's a good story and the pictures look pretty, I'm happy. For me, it doesn't need to be in 3D to deliver that.
Yeah, I mean, the technical side of that 3D rendering has been enabled by RenderMan now, I think, from version 13. And actually, it's incredibly efficient to render the second eye. It's not, you know, twice as much work. So once you've worked out the animation, having said that, you're probably going to want to tweak some of the stereoscopic effects for doing that. But, you know, theoretically, the render overhead isn't that bad. So I don't mind that they're doing stereo, but you're absolutely right. I mean, I didn't need stereo in this film. I would hate stereo to have gotten in the way. I'd hate to do scenes that had a stereo gag just for its own sake.
Yeah, I think we're safe with Pixar. They're not going to do the flying knives at the screen kind of thing. I think they're above that.
Well, there was actually another short shown at the actually Autodesk users group meeting, which was, now I'm going to get the name wrong, but it's it was a Disney film of which John Lasseter was actually given an EP credit, and it was a film called, I'm going to say Glasnost's Guest, but I'm going to get that wrong. And the film was a classic Pixar type short, only this time done by the guys over at Disney. And the film, I can spell it for you because I really can't. It's Glagos, Guest. And I bring it up because it was in stereo and it was delightful, but anything, it wasn't anything like the sort of classic Pixar stuff in a way. It was much more kind of realistic Russian guy at an outpost. Did you get a chance to see it?
I didn't. I was too busy elsewhere, but I heard it was good.
It was good and it was delightful and it was engaging and it was, if you get a chance to see it, you should do it. What was interesting though about it is it was in stereo. Lasseter, as I said, was involved with it. This is the sort of new reborn Disney under John Lasseter, but at no point did there feel like there were any stereo gags in it. Like, you know what I mean? Like it wasn't a film played for the stereo gags. And I really hope that that's a taste of what we're going to see when Pixar decides to go with 3D stereoscopic, that we're going to get the same quality performances. And the fact that it happens to be in stereo, in that case, was gorgeous, right? Because there's huge wide shots of this poor guy stuck in the middle of nowhere at this outpost. So, you know, if that's any indication of how it's going to go, that'd be great. Because, I mean, it wouldn't ruin it for me to see that film in mono, but in stereo it did feel nice and it was, you know, engaging.
Now, do you think Smell-O-Vision's going to come back? Because, I mean, there's a question for Wally. Would you really want to smell that huge pile of trash?
I hadn't thought of that. No, that would be particularly difficult. Now, I don't think that'll come back, though obviously at a theme park, we were at the California theme park, which is, you know, the next door to Disney down a couple of years ago, like 18 months ago. And in one of those rides, as you go over the orange groves, they actually do whiff out and
awesome.
Give you kind of orange scent as you fly down and over the Napa Valley and stuff. It's gorgeous. But no, I don't really think I needed that. And I regret the fact that you brought it up.
Maybe going back to Ratatouille with Smell-O-Vision. Now, that would be good.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to see how everyone approaches this 3D world.
Yeah, no, totally. So no criticisms. It's hard to level much in the way of criticism at Wall-E.
If I had any, there was a couple of shots that were, you know, classic cheesy moments, but every film's got to have those moments. Just, I guess, the shots where he's coming through space and you've got lots of beautiful nebula shots.
I like those. I didn't like the... I mean, this is so ridiculous to be picky. I didn't like the particle systems on the fire extinguisher. especially in the trailer, they looked to me like they were just a bunch of dashed line particle emitters from what you could get out of a flame, actually. I looked terribly, you know, circa 6-7 years ago. And I don't, maybe it's just because it was a trailer shot. I tried looking at them again in the film. And you know what? I was kind of in the story at that point and forgot to kind of stare at them. I think they were different than they were in the trailer. In the trailer, they were pretty like...
Yeah, there seemed like a couple of things that were in the trailer that had been refined for the actual finished film.
Yeah, I mean, Lord only knows at what point they had to actually commit to those trailer shots, obviously way before they were finished on the actual film. Well, I guess the big thumbs up from us, both from a technical point of view, a creative point of view, and just generally, you know, there are worse things in the world to spend your afternoon sitting watching...
I loved it. Anyone who hasn't seen it, hop on a plane and come to the El Capitan Theatre to have a look.
Yeah, definitely one of the best viewing environments possible.
And I think, you know, we also have to say a big happy birthday to RenderMan because, you know, it's that kind of technology that's got getting these films looking so darn tops.
You're absolutely right. 80 to 90% of all feature films use RenderMan from Pixar. And it's a, you know... phenomenal contribution to the industry. Actually, Ed Catmull at SIDGRAPH completely committed to keeping RenderMan for everybody. And that, you know, they're really not trying to grow it and expand it or, you know, go into other markets. They're just doing what they do with it. And
doing it well.
Yeah, so 20 years since RenderMan, release 14 at the moment. And as you say, it's a big happy birthday. So thanks, Matt, for taking time to you know, go see the film. Obviously, hard work for you.
Yeah, it was. Popcorn and pink lemonade.
And like me, I'm sure you'll be queuing up at the gift shop to get Wall-E toys to take home to the girls.
Show me the merchandise.
All right. Well, until next time, we just want to thank the producers, who some of which you actually met here in SIDGRAPH at a rooftop party. When I say met, we had a party here at SIDGRAPH for FX Guide, and a bunch of the producers and researchers of the VFX show came along, so we want to thank them. I want to thank everybody at the Pixel Corps who helps put the show together and research it. We'll be back next week when we finally get back to our respective homes and fly. I'm quite frankly over it. I want to go home now. It's been good, but I miss my bed. I miss my family. But anyway, until next time, I'm Mike Seymour.
I'm Matt Graham.
Thanks, guys. See ya.
Cheers.